everyone. Now, every morning at 8 a.m, just before my videos go out, I have shorts, little minute-long things where I do a piece to camera and I give some, like, helpful bit of life advice or wax lyrical about something or other. And somebody asked me, could I put them all together in a video for your viewing pleasure? And this is that video. So this is the first 60 shorts where I did the pieces to camera with my face, usually chugging on a cigar. And without further ado, let's get on with it. I'll just remind everybody, do buy courses at the academic agency, promo code SHORJAN. I won't subject you to the whole ad. I'll play it right at the end. But yeah, buy it now. And here are the 60 maxims for life. Spirit or energy may be ignited for a time by exceptional leaders or men of action, but their beliefs, their doctrines, are much less important than their vitality. It is their vitality, their kind of natural aura, their charisma. Charisma is too weak a word, really, that finally animates men. And when it becomes crystallized into a doctrine or set of ideologies or set of bullet points, that vitality is often lost. This is the difference between Odinic and Tyric that Mike from Imperium sometimes talks about. Pedram Gonzalez, for example, does not understand this about Donald Trump. Now, you should assume almost everything that you were taught about history in school or even in university was propaganda, and it was designed to foster in you this idea that the current moment, the current system that we have, liberal democracy, was a kind of enlightened end state for history against which all previous history is judged. The past is to be denigrated as superstitious, bigoted, you know, we know so much better now, they were intolerant, etc., etc. And once you see that much of what you were taught was basically that same lesson over and over again, you can then start to disregard most of the stuff you were taught. This is why I recommend read books written before 1945. Now, another thing that you should do when you're thinking about history is not to assume that the people from the past were backwards or barbaric, but actually that they knew what they were doing, that any law they made was brought in to solve an actual problem. And once you do this, you can see how much the past is lied about by our current moment. I remember, for example, looking into burning witches and discovering that most of them had, you know, murdered someone, often their husbands. When you discover that fact, it starts to look less irrational. Now, you should treat with automatic suspicion any book that is promoted by mainstream culture, especially books promoted by The Guardian. The question we always have to ask is, why does the regime want me to read this book? How does it further their ends? What part of the ideological modus operandi of the current moment is being advanced? In my experience, mainstream books almost always have, at the very least, a poison pill in them. Something that will take you off the path of discovering the truth. Something that will obscure some element of the past. Something that will lie. So follow that rule. Whenever possible, try to consult books that were written before 1945. You can actually take that date forward a little bit. You can take it forward to about 1964, something like that. Actually, I find a lot of good books are written in the little period before, after the end of World War II and before about 1964, especially British authors in that time. guys who served in the war, people like Major General Richard Hilton and people like that. But in general, you need to consult earlier books where possible, because they are not contaminated with all of the assumptions of what I call the boomer truth regime. So that's why I recommend books before 1945, wherever possible. At the very least, you're confronted with a different belief system. Now, if the official explanation for something is they were just evil, almost certainly you're being lied to. The answer is almost never they were just evil. There's usually, I mean, it goes back to some of the other previous points I made on earlier shorts. It is simply not human nature to just do stuff, to take kind of political decisions, society-wide decisions, just because you're evil. There's usually a good reason there. And whenever that kind of canard comes out, you just know you're being lied to. You're in the realm of Bashar al-Assad is using chemical weapons on children for no reason. Never count out the possibility that official records have been destroyed or falsified. I first got interested in this when I discovered that the census records, the American census records from New York, for key years went missing. And when investigations were done into this, there was a mysterious fire that destroyed all the records. Now, we don't need to get into who that was, why that was, but that made me think, well, you know, what records can be trusted? Especially if they're coming from the regime, and especially from the Allied powers. If something is banned or censored, that is a good enough reason to read it. Now, this is one of those ironies, because the left are always talking about how they read censored books, but the books they're talking about were banned like in the 1920s or something. I'm talking about books that are banned now. A good example was Scott Howard's Transgender Industrial Complex, banned on Amazon. Immediate buy. Clearly there's something in there that they don't want you to read. Any book that is banned must have something that they want to hide. Just stands to reason. Now, if a story is turned into a film, the version given in the film is very likely to be the exact opposite of what happened. And you'd be surprised how often that is the case. You know, literally the exact opposite of the real story. That is because much of our history, as I've been talking about, is falsified. And in a sense, they always need to lie about their enemies in order to justify their own actions. You're all familiar with the concept of projection. It's always projection with the left, as my friend says. But the same is true of their enemies through history, which is basically all of history. If anyone comes to you pre-smeared by the press or by Wikipedia, for example, that person is probably onto something. Pre-smearing is one of their best ways of making sure that somebody is not listened to. So for that reason, just like with the banned books, you should probably listen to that person. Their system is really very straightforward. It's quite simplistic. The regime is often given credit for being, you know, masters of propaganda or something, but really it's very basic, a lot of this stuff. You know, smear someone so they're not listened to, or just outright ban it. Same playbook over and over and over again all throughout recent history. Now, if you're at university and you have a teacher or a professor, for example, who presents you two sides of an argument and then asks you to kind of assess which one's right, I would immediately move beyond the dichotomy, assume it's a false dichotomy, and assume that the dichotomy is a containment in some way that is boxing in your thinking in a way that constrains it within the safe boundaries of regime thinking. And I would encourage you always to do that, even in cases where it seems innocuous. Usually there'll be some third or fourth position that is not represented, that is precluded, that is automatically considered beyond the pale or whatever, and you should do your best to seek out that position. So someone wanted to know what counter-signalling is. Basically, that is when somebody who is a friend, a political friend, and is on the same side as you, is publicly counter-signal, that is, you publicly say something to disagree with them in a manner which accentuates the disagreement. That is a counter-signal. And I guess the reason it's highlighted is because there's this philosophy, you know, never punch right, and all disagreement then is seen through this prism. So, you know, aka don't counter signal. Not sure I stand on it, but that is what it means. There's a guy in my comments who keeps on asking me, what is based? You keep on using this word, what is it? Well, I believe its original conception was, it just meant something like, be true to yourself. You don't really care what other people think. You're not going for social acceptance or status or something. You're just true to who you are. That was the original conception. Over time, it has come to be code for, you know, you have the right kind of opinions on certain things. I've seen leftists use it as well as rightists, but that is, it's kind of transformed over time to mean you have the right sort of views. So what is slop? Why am I as against it as I am? Slop is basically, I mean, probably the best example I can think of is Tim Pool. There's going to be a civil war, guys. Oh, I can't believe it. It's going to be a civil war. It's when the news cycle becomes such a major part of your life that you become emotionally invested in its storylines and you react to it as if you have a stake. This goes against the principle of riding the tiger, which I advocate. And I think it's bad for your mental health to be too invested in the slop, as Tim Pool is. Of course, he's got other reasons, his bank account. Now, this phrase, nobody's coming to save you, is often repeated. And I kind of swing back and forth as to whether it should be adopted or not. Because on the one hand, the notion that there will be the kind of King Arthur who or returns with a V one day gives everybody hope. But on the other hand, it also perhaps gets people in this mode where you just kind of, like the Q-tards, sit back, watch the show, you know, everything's going to be all right, trust the plan type thing. And that promotes inactivity and passivity. So that is why people use this phrase, nobody's coming to save you, to stop looking for these, you know, ciphers. Like Elon Musk, for example, is he really going to be your king? Questions to be asked. You know, people are always telling you to touch grass. Get offline. Which I always find interesting because I spend a lot of time outside. I'm outside right now. can see the grass beneath my feet. I go on country walks, take my daughter out all the time. The trouble is, and I've talked about this before, touching grass is a state of mind, or being online is a state of mind. Much like Mephistopheles in Dr. Faustus, or Satan in Paradise Lost, or something like that. That even though you're out and in nature, for example, you're still not offline. You're still in your head, online. That is something I struggle with, to be honest. Even when I'm somewhere else, I'm possibly not there in my head. Truth is, it's never over. In my book, The Prophets of Doom, I ended with a bit about Persia, which has obviously had ups in history and many downs in history, times where they've been completely conquered by other people, but they always found a way of coming back. And the notion that Europe or the West or Western man or something, it can't come back just because we're facing a bit of adversity is a nonsense. So I would never get into the this notion that things are just completely lost. There's no utility in that, and it's just not true. So it might take a long time, but it's never over. Now there's a utility in just flouting or laughing at or disregarding and treating as unimportant their sacred cows and their taboos, just trample all over them. Now, obviously, especially in a country like Britain, you have to be careful because there are laws in place and yada yada yada. So you have to box clever always. You know, don't put yourself under unnecessary, the danger with the law or anything like that. But, you know, one of the ways of defeating what I call boomer truth ultimately will just be to step over, as a great man once said. And there is a utility in that, and I'm actually seeing it all the time, where people just don't care about their sacred cows anymore. Now, frame is very important, especially, I mean, it's important in life, it's important in your personal relationships as well, but especially in political relations in this day and age, you have to force them to come to your frame. You have to make them justify themselves to you. They are the extremists trying to do something that's never been done before in human history. You are the normal one. You are the one who is defending human life as it has always been. Thousands of years on your side. They've got nothing on their side. They are the extremists, and therefore they must constantly be forced to justify themselves to all of us and not the other way around. This is something I made a longer video about, but it's worth repeating. In the dialectic, they should be reacting to you and not vice versa. If you're reacting, you're losing. If they're reacting, you're winning. You should also adopt a strategy of no dialogue. The dialectic is you put stuff out there, they respond. Never vice versa. So don't get bogged down in an argument over, boys and girls, your sex is, biological sex is real. It's not up for debate. You, in fact, just advance your agenda. How about starting, race is real. They can respond to that. Better that way around, yeah? Now, the Overton window is a concept that I think has limited value. Does it really exist? Is it really a thing? Or can you set the terms of discourse and force other people to argue on your grounds, regardless of where Overton window is? I think is rhetorically stronger, to just move beyond any notion of an Overton window. What does that mean? Who does it give power to? These questions to be asked. Ignore the Overton window. Smash the Overton window. Gives you more power. It's empowering to move beyond it. Whatever you focus on gives power to that thing, whether it's positive or negative. If you constantly focus on some negative thing, some fear that you have, it is more likely to happen. If you focus on positive things or change that you want to see happen, it is more likely to happen if you focus on it in that direction. This is an eternal law of the universe, really. And the more people focus on things they want to see, the more likely they are to happen. It kind of swings both ways as well. For example, the more our elites focus on the rise of, you know, fascism or whatever, the more likely it is it to manifest. But this is a principle that you can, not just in politics, but in life in general, I would strongly advocate. It's kind of an eternal principle, esoteric knowledge. The ideas of the left always date quickly and look stupid 5, 10, 20 years after the fact. The concerns of the left always date in this way because their fundamental premises about the world are untrue. Whereas rightist thinking, knowledge, wisdom is eternal, which is why our thinkers never date. You can pick up Thomas Carlyle and find truths in there. Whereas you can pick up his contemporaries, his leftist contemporaries, and find most of their predictions did not come to pass, whereas most of Carlyle's did. This is a recurring feature right through recent history. Worth remembering. Remember, they have no power over you. This is a line actually from the film The Labyrinth that Sarah says to Jareth at the end. You have no power over me. You have no power over me. But it's actually important to internalize that fact. They do not have power over you. They could even stick you in a jail cell, and they still don't have power over you. There have been people in history who've been subjected to all sorts of terrible things, tortures and so on. They still don't have power over you, as long as you remain true to your core. And that is ultimately a mindset that you need to cultivate in yourself. Now, I'm not saying that you should put yourself in a position where you should go to jail. You shouldn't. But you should have that inner internal strength. They do not have power over you. Now, you are the center of your own reality, which means that there is nothing stopping you from being who you were born to be. When you point to external factors, external constraints, they won't let us do this, they won't let us do that, the government, this group, that group, you're giving them power. And really, you need to recenter. When I talk about being sensible and centered, the centered part is very important, that you embody the frame of being the boss of your own reality. This is very important for all of our people. Now, related to what I was saying just now, if you want to do something, you should just go ahead and do it. Don't ask for permission. Don't look for reasons not to. Don't ask somebody else's opinion. Just go ahead and fucking do it. Now, it could be a mistake, what you're doing, but you have to make that yourself. And it's better to go ahead and do the thing and, let's say, regret doing it than living with the idea that you didn't do it, that you weren't allowed to do it. I'm not saying kind of seize the day, carpe diem, all that sort of stuff is trite in a way. What I'm saying is that if you're looking for reasons to not do something, to talk yourself out of doing something that you really deep down want to do, you should do it.
Now, you as a man have duties and obligations that solely come down to you, and you cannot shrink from them. You have to face them, and you have to embrace them, and you have to take ownership over them. If you start making excuses, if you start looking to other people, again, like I've been saying, if you start asking for permission, you're not fulfilling your duty, you're not fulfilling your obligations that have been placed on you by your ancestors. And I think every man should feel that weight and should take it on his own shoulders. And it's not easy, and it can be stressful, but you have to do it, because that is part and parcel of what it is to be a man. Now, recently I've been talking about ways to empower yourself and to fulfill your duties and obligations as a man. One of the important things, I think, is to embody a mindset where you're unstoppable, unshakable. Nothing can divert you from your chosen path, whatever that path happens to be. This can be difficult to achieve mentally and spiritually, but it is important to develop an inner steel that's not going to divert you. It doesn't matter what other people say. It doesn't matter at all. You know what is best, and you have to do what is best. In these past few videos, these shorts, I've been talking about, being the center of your own reality. And some people may object. They say, well, but my wife, but my significant other, invariably it'll be a woman that they'll have in mind, telling them this and that. The truth is that women will always shit test. Women will always test you. They will always have things that try to knock you off your path. And basically you just have to take that, accept it, know that they're going to do it, and just move beyond it. And once you embody this mindset, women won't be a problem anymore. And men can shit test you too. If they're a good man, or if they're a good friend to you, they'll try to do it in such a way that will ultimately pull you up. Now, there's another sort of man, kind of beaterish individual, that will try to bring you down, try to tear you down, and you have to just ignore those, or see them as what they are, which is pathetic and small, and take on board the tests, if you want, from those people who are actually trying to bring you up in different ways. And I do think one of the positive things of, the community that we have online here is there are a lot of men that do actually try to bring each other up, and that's a good thing, and it should be encouraged. A lot of people obsess about the left having taken over all the institutions and having so much power and all of this sort of thing. But the truth is that even with all of that behind them, they still have nothing. The truly important, powerful things are still in our hands. And despite all of their efforts, they have failed to destroy any of those things that matter. And as long as you keep them all alive, there's nothing they can do at all. So have kids and make sure the torch is passed on. Well, you can complain about the boomers not passing on various things to us, but we know better, and we can pass it on, and we will. In these past few videos, these shorts, I've been talking about, being the center of your own reality. And some people may object. They say, well, but my wife, but my significant other, invariably it'll be a woman that they'll have in mind, telling them this and that. The truth is that Women will always shit test. Women will always test you. They will always have things that try to knock you off your path. And basically, you just have to take that, accept it, know that they're going to do it, and just move beyond it. And once you embody this mindset, women won't be a problem anymore. Other groups have no bearing on the destiny of your group. This is actually something I learned watching a couple of Jewish people talking once. Leon Weisleiter and a couple of other people. Some of you will know the video. And Leon at one point says, well, the destiny of the... He says the Goyim have no hand in the destiny of the Jews. That is, in Jewish hands. And I thought, well, that is an extremely powerful frame to come from the point of view of his people. And it is one that every other group should adopt as well. I can think of many groups that essentially outsource their power to some other external force. This is the wrong way to go about it. Leon, the Jewish people who say that are basically right. Their own destiny is in their own hands, and so is yours for your group.
The other day I accidentally released a video under the wrong title. It was meant to be about nostalgia. This one actually is about nostalgia. Now, my basic point is that nostalgia has a very strong grip on some of us. Me especially, I'm very prone to nostalgia. And I kind of go back and forth, you know, is it kind of mental trap to want to relive parts of your childhood? Or is it a good motivation to make a better future? And I actually lean more on the side of the latter. Many great things have come from men of nostalgia. I think of Disneyland, for example, or the Thomas the Tank books, or the Trumpdom, or many of the great things that we like tend to come from this nostalgic element. The very notion of return actually is a forward-looking thing rather than a backward-looking thing.
Remember Vladimir Putin once used this phrase, the Empire of Lies. I thought it was a pretty good phrase because it summed up the deceit that pervades through everything. There's deceit at the heart of the system, at the top of the system, and it filters down. In my view, this basically compromises all nodes that touch the system, because anybody who gets involved with it will feel the need to compromise on the truth in some way, or to suppress what they really think, or to lie, or even worse, to deceive themselves into believing the lies of the regime. And this is a very difficult problem, because it means that no element or no actor who really intersects with the regime writ large can ever really truly be trusted. I think it's a pretty good heuristic to assume that they are compromised in some way. Now, once, some years ago, I was working at this job. I was working as a research analyst, and my head of content and I clashed extremely badly. In fact, we came to cross words a number of times. I remember one time we even had a whole bust-up over one word. I wanted to use regarding, he wanted to use as regards in this report that we were writing. I don't deal well with people who try to micromanage me, or indeed with people who think that they can get one up with using little petty bits of power. This chap was not fit to lace my boots, truth be told, and if you know me, I'm not going to take shit from anyone. Now, I just got married at the time, and I didn't have a lot of money. I had a mortgage to pay. I was a young man, and one day he just wound me up to that extent where I just said, listen, stick your job, you're a CONT, and I walked out. So yesterday I talked about a situation where I walked out of a job when I really needed the money. And it just turns out that on that occasion, within a week, I had a new job, 6K pay rise at that time for me. So I landed on my feet, as I often have. The point of needing to walk away sometimes, or being prepared to walk away, is that sometimes it can give you the kick up the arse that you actually need. What I actually needed to do was to leave that job. Now, I did it in quite a dramatic fashion, but the necessity of needing to find a new job basically gave me that kick up the arse I needed to crack on and actually take the next step in my what was my career at that point. And I've done similar things at various points where you have this kind of sudden shift, a sudden change. Sometimes it can do you good. Now, you sometimes get people who think that they can work within the system to advance their political goals and indeed their personal ambitions. In my experience, whenever I've seen people do this, whether it's in Washington or in Westminster, they seem to kind of give a little piece of their soul away. And you can tell that there's something a little bit off about that person, that you need to treat them with a modicum of skepticism and possibly even distrust. And the reason for that is because you know they're Machiavellian enough to make those kind of compromises. So it's your natural spidey senses kicking in, being like, well, this is the sort of person who one day in the future could screw me over, because they're a Machiavellian, a low Machiavellian, and therefore not to be trusted. Now, speaking of the low Machiavellian, which I talked about yesterday, there's something else that the system almost requires people to do after a certain kind of threshold of influence, and that is they kind of require you to start toadying, in a way. I actually saw Chris Rufo do this a couple of weeks back. It was obsequious. It was sniveling. It was disgusting, really. And nobody likes to see somebody debase themselves in that way. Nobody likes a toady. This is something that you can see in Shakespeare's plays, the obsequious characters, the servile characters. It's actually considered a sin by Thomas Aquinas, and this is something that all of Shakespeare's audience would have understood. You know, a good servant is not obsequious in that manner, and yet we see such sniveling behavior all the time in modern politics. Now, people have often asked me about how I'm so productive, how I get so much done. You know, I'd written 5 books by the time I was younger than 38, I think it was. Obviously you've seen my work rate on the channel and so on. My answer's always been the same, which is sometimes you have to be prepared to do nothing if the inspiration is not taking you, and then trust that at some point your drive to actually do something will kick in and take over. And I usually find that if I have that bit of time out where I just kick back, watch a few movies, take some time out, take the kid out, whatever, you know, take some time off, basically, usually you can come back stronger. Or sometimes you need a change, as I've been talking about recently. Now, yesterday I talked about productivity and taking time out. Now, obviously, if you're always taking time out, you'll never get anything done. And one of the ways I mitigate against that is by taking deadlines really seriously. Somebody sets you a deadline, stick to it, and basically bust your ass to make that deadline as and where it's required. I remember I wrote a book in a week once because I was so busy I didn't have a chance to do it, and I basically had to take a week out, and I just came there, barely slept, and wrote an entire book in a week. One of my most cited books, bizarrely, was written in that way. So it's always possible to kind of, you kind of need a push and pull. Sometimes the urgency of a deadline can actually kick your ass into gear sometimes as well, and you need both. You need the time out and you also need the deadline, in my view. So another issue is, how can you be consistent when you're a mercurial personality, as I am, as I'm sure many of you are, where you have a kind of creative personality type, and you know, you're a bit whimsical, kind of follow your moods and your whims, as I'm wont to do, and yet you know, you set yourself a schedule where you need to be consistent. Like, for example, since the revamp, I've set myself 5 videos a week. You know, that's a lot to keep up with on a daily basis. So how can I manage it? Well, one of the ways that I've thought about doing that is, you know, you basically do all the work when you're in that zone and try to get as much in the bank as possible so that then you can also have those 2, 3, even 4 days sometimes where you need to take that time out. So you have to kind of know yourself and work to your strengths. Now, obviously, everybody cares about what other people think of them, regardless of what they say. And everybody wants the feeling of being liked. This is just kind of human nature. And yet, sometimes you have to get yourself into a zone where you just really, really don't care about what anybody else says, thinks, or does, or thinks of you, says about you. It can be difficult, trust me. You know, especially when you see hundreds, thousands of comments about you, sometimes having a go at you every single day, as anybody with a large YouTube channel no doubt sees. You know, especially with my face out there, I've been on, made media appearances and things like that, bound to happen. But really, your nexus of value has to be internal, not external. You can care about what other people think of you, but it can never be the source of your validation. So yesterday I talked about your validation needing to be internal and not external, which is easier said than done, because everybody has some desire for social proof. They like to feel like other people are taking them seriously in some way. But you have to overcome this as a psychological matter and as a spiritual matter. The strength has to come from within, has to be internal, everything internal and nothing external. And then you'll be able to speak from a position of true authenticity if that's the case, because you're not really thinking about how you come across. You know, and like I said, this is easier said than done, and nobody's perfect, including me, of course, but you practice it over time, you really do truly stop caring. Well, I've always thought it's been important to know your strengths and weaknesses and to know your limitations as well as your strengths, and also not to try to compete in those areas where you know some other guy is better, basically. And you're going to get situations where some guy is better than you in every single respect. I've yet to meet anyone who's better than me at certain things, but you know, there's plenty of guys who are better than me at basically all other things, right? For example, and you basically just have to get over that, because you're not going to be able to compete in every single aspect of life. Sometimes, you know, you just have to be like, well, that guy is the shit in that, and kind of come to peace with it. And I people will respect that more than if you're always trying to prove yourself in every single field. Now, you're never going to get away from the masculine desire to compete, the kind of natural jockeying that takes place. I'll never forget, it was my graduation day, back when I graduated as an undergraduate now. And, you know, people go around saying, well, what was your highest mark? Well, my highest mark was 86. Which was, you know, practically unheard of in English to have a mark that high. And, you know, I was a pretty good student. That's how I ended up, you know, taking the career path that I did. I was good at research, good at writing, etc. And I'll never forget, there was another guy who was also pretty good. And he said, oh, well, my highest mark was 87. Well, years later, I ended up working in the data management office there, just as a kind of temp job. And I remember looking up his marks and finding out that he had lied. But his desire to compete in that moment and not kind of let me have the victory was enough that he would lie just to save face in the moment. I learned a lesson there. So one of the things I've always remembered that Uncle Ted talked about surrogate activities. And, well, I mean, just like that bird tweeting there, there's a lot of things in life that we have no control over. And one of the things I've kind of settled on doing, see, I have no control over that bird, and I'm cool with that, you know, I can't control it, is to keep your world relatively small, to keep your actual world, the things you have control over, relatively small and stable. And that, I think, is better for your kind of well-being, your mental health, your sense of yourself, etc., if you keep that world small, rather than you know, it feeling vast and out of control and, you know, over a set of variables that basically, just like that bird, you have no control over. Now, perfectionism is a form of procrastination. Sometimes when you're working on a project, you've done enough. You've basically done enough and you need to get it done and get it in. There's always something else you could look up. There's always some extra stone to unturn. There's always something else that could be better, something else you could do. That's just true of anything. It will never actually reach that final state of perfection. So you're actually kind of like Sisyphus pushing a boulder up, which is only going to fall down again. And in my experience, you have to kind of get over that need to be the perfectionist, because otherwise you can kind of, one, you get less stuff done, and two, you can kind of drive yourself crazy over those sorts of things. So you just have to kind of, you know, just get it done at the end of the day. One of the things that often drives me crazy is people often feel the need that in order to push something up, they need to pull some other thing down. And usually the two things aren't even that related, but they feel the need to make these comparisons in order to put the thing that they want over. I think it's better not to do that pulling down mechanism. Rather, just talk something up. You don't need to also pull something else down at the same time. And I actually think it's more convincing, because if the other person likes that other thing, their kind of heuristic brain will kick in and they'll dig their heels in. They're more likely to say, well, actually, you like that thing, I like this thing, right? So it's actually persuasively a poor tactic. Now, in this world, there'll be people who like you and people who don't like you. You should never be bothered by the people who don't like you or make an effort to try to win those people over. When I was younger, it used to bother me a lot. I'd instantly know, and I'd think, why doesn't that person like me? I need to try to make an effort or something to try to win them over. As time has gone on, and it took me a long time to come to this, you know, when I say that I was younger, like when I was in my early 20s, by the time I was in my early 30s, I'd learned to kind of live with this and just be cool with it. You just have to leave them go. Write them off. They're lost. Okay, it's their loss. Done. Much better. You're much truer to yourself than if you're tripping over yourself trying to get in that person's good books. Fuck them. Now, in my experience, people have a habit of letting you down, or they have a habit of not coming through with the things that they say they're going to do. This is especially true of younger people, students and people like that, of course, but it's true of everybody, basically. And my view on this is that if you have the lowest possible expectations, i.e. if somebody says they're going to do something, expect them not to come through. Expect them not to come through. And then if they do, you can be pleasantly surprised, basically. And then if they continue to keep on coming through all the time, you're like, well, this is somebody who clearly has something about them. And there have been plenty of examples of those people. And that's basically one of the ways that I can build up trust with somebody, is that I know when they say they're going to do something, they will actually do it, which is actually quite rare. Most people will let you down, but you should expect it in life and in work especially. Now, one of the things that especially young academics experience a lot, but I think a lot of people experience it in many different lines of work, something called imposter syndrome. This is actually a real thing, and I don't think it's something that we should just ignore or dismiss. What imposter syndrome is basically your body telling you, actually, you need to level up here. You do not have the expertise necessary to do this, so you need to actually acquire it. You need to get the XP in and become the expert in that field that you are advertised at. So the imposter syndrome is literally just that. Now, the people who don't take that signal and carry on talking about it, I mean, they are basically imposters. you need to not be the imposter by becoming the real deal. Now, people use this phrase, fake it till you make it. Some people rework this a little bit when they talk about LARPing. You know, you're a LARPer until you're not a LARPer, i.e. you fake it until it becomes real. Now, I'm skeptical about putting it in those specific terms, but there is a kind of truth to it, which is that if you form an identity of yourself as, you know, like, for example, it's a Partagas Cuban cigar here, okay? Now, if it's just part of my core identity that I am the sort of guy who smokes Cuban cigars, that it's just something that is part of who I am, okay? Then you kind of, reality aligns to making that the case, if that makes any sense, okay? Because it becomes part of your core. And, you know, this is just one silly example, but you can use it in every other aspect of life as well. And magic things happen. Now, sometimes the most powerful thing you can do in a situation is just to do something. Just act. Act first. And then the reality is already changed. You've already acted. And everything else has to realign to that. This is actually something I learned from a certain Dark Lord, Tony Blair, but it can apply in normal life as well. Now, of course, that means you increase your risk, you increase the chance of making a mistake, you increase the chance of disruption by acting first, right? But I swear there's been about 20 planes in this recording session. 20 planes already. Anyway, you understand my point. Sometimes it's better to act. Because sometimes thinking is basically just delaying acting. Sometimes it's better to just do and then see how the dice fall. Well, your reason for doing something should never be to please somebody else, because you'll never actually please them. Whether it's your boss, your dad, your partner, your husband or wife or whatever, if your motivation is to please them, you're doing something wrong. You're getting the wrong thing from it. You're looking for the wrong thing. And you're basically asking for a hiding to nothing. So in a sense, you have to just get over that. Which can be difficult. Especially if you have a strong personality in any one of those roles. Many people will have a strong father, for example. But in a way, what Freud says is right. You have to kind of... occasionally I see a comment saying things like, are you a Nietzschean? Or something like that. Some of my advice, are you coming from this school? Or are you coming from that school? Most of the kind of advice I've been giving out on these little shorts has been about being your most authentic self and being kind of true to your core in that way. And now you could say, well, hold on, I've listened to your advice and that's not true to my core at all. You know, maybe because you're a woman, for example, or maybe because you're a man who has a strong feminine essence or something like this. In which case, that is fine. But just be sure that your sense of your true self is not a kind of false consciousness, because it could be just a kind of defense mechanism to prevent becoming who you need to be. Could be. Now, I think it's really important to have heroes in this world. Like, for example, I've often said some of my heroes and inspirations are Sir Alex Ferguson, you know, this is manager of Manchester United, Vince McMahon. But you might say, well, hold on a second, you know, Vince McMahon, for example, is now known as being a kind of, involved in some kind of sex perversion or something, you know. He's had his reputation attacked recently, or he's done some bad things or whatever. And the important thing is basically you can make a division between, like, well, why is this person your hero, and what aspect of them is it that you admire? Now, obviously, it's not those aspects of Vince. It is specifically as regards how he created that world, how he, you know, his creative and business vision, or, you know, same with Alex Ferguson, for example. Doesn't really matter if he liked to drink or whatever, because it's irrelevant. You know, every politician is going to let you down because there's an incentive within our system to lie before an election and then to basically do the opposite of what you promise after the election. Those incentives are cast in iron at this point. I really struggle to believe, or like, I can't really understand how every single election cycle comes and goes, people get their hopes up again, or they start believing the bullshit again. In the current incentive structure, there is no incentive, basically, to fix any of the issues that people have. Beyond regime legitimacy, which I've talked about before. In which case, it will only be a kind of perception management thing anyway. I wouldn't expect any real fixes. Him, look at his stupid pig face, willingly lying to millions of people to lead them to their death and to his own country's ultimate demise. Just wanting to look at his face for a moment. I hate him so much.
Sure. Yeah. Sure, 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 and so, sure.
Sure, Dan.
Can you command a comma like Joseph Conrad?
Sure, sure, sure,
sure, sure, and sure, Dan.
Are you magnificent in your mastery of marginalism like Murray Rothbard?
Sure.
Sure, Dan.
Are you legendary in your logical leveling of lamentable loquacity?
Sure.
Sure, Dan.
Come on down to the January sale at the Academic Agency. Promo code SHORJAN for 25% off. All this January, I got more courses than the Queen had horses.
Sure, Dan.
I got better rates than Andrew Tate's had mates.
Sure, Dan.
I got better deals than Lizzo's had meals.
Sure.
Sure, Dan.
And so, sure, 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 and so, sure, 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 and so, sure.
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the Academic Agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends,
get out.